This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Cane River by Lalita Tatamy, narrated by Robin Miles. This work is copyrighted 2001. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. Lalita Tatamy, a former vice president of Sun Microsystems, left the corporate world to immerse herself in tracing her family's history and writing this, her first novel. In it, she presents a rarely seen part of American history, creating a saga of real flesh and blood women who make hard choices in the face of unimaginable loss. And now, Cane River.
Part 1. Suzette. Chapter 1. Cane River, Louisiana, 1834. On the morning of her 9th birthday, the day after Madame Françoise d'Urban slapped her, Suzette peed on the rose bushes. Before the plantation bell sounded, she had startled awake, tuned her ears to the careless breathing of Mamselle above her in the four-poster bed, listened for movement from the rest of the sleeping household, and quietly pushed herself up from her straw pallet on the floor. Suzette made her way quickly down the narrow hall, beyond the wall altar, and past the polished mahogany grandfather clock in the front room, careful to sidestep the squeaky board by the front door. Outside on the gallery, her heart thudded so wildly that the curiosity of the sound helped soften the fear. Her breath felt too big for her chest as she inched past the separate entrance to the stranger's room and around the side of the big house where the prized bushes waited. Barefoot into the darkness, aided only by the slightest remnant of the Louisiana summer moon, she chose Madame's favorite, a sprawling rose bush with delicate pale yellow flowers and visible roots as long as her father's fiddling bow. The task didn't take long, going and coming back, and Orlean's breathing was still soft and regular when Suzette slipped back onto her makeshift mattress at the foot of the bed. The only evidence that Suzette had been gone at all was a thin, jagged scratch on her bare arm from a thorn she hadn't seen in the darkness. The day before had started with midsummer Louisiana predictability, so smotheringly hot that the spongy air seemed to push down on Suzette as she hurried to the cookhouse after church. Once there, she slipped a clean apron over her good dress, a loose-fitting dark calico with a yoke neck, one of Orlean's last season cast-offs her mother had altered to fit the girl's small body. Her mother had left room in the dress for a growth spurt. Every last item of Suzette's clothing, from undershift to leggings and shoes, had first belonged to her mamselle. Although the girls were the same age, Orlean was taller than Suzette by half a head. They made an odd pair, the pale white girl, long-legged and gangly as a young colt, and her tiny cocoa-colored nurse, Suzette, with skin like strong coffee after the splash of cream. Suzette's eager smile showed off a gap between her two front teeth. The space was almost the width of a full kernel of corn, and Suzette used it to give more force to her whistle. It came in handy for calling chickens or pigs or for impressing Orlean and Narcisse when they ran the woods together in play. The added heat from the blazing cookhouse fires made Suzette's dress stick to her as she worked the paddle of the butter churn. Built at a distance from the main house because of the risk of fire, the cookhouse belonged to the d'Urbans, along with the cotton and corn fields, the swamp lands, the facing rows of 8 slave cabins in the quarter, 4 on each side, and every other living thing on Rosedew, their plantation along Bayou d'Urban. Suzette looked over to her mother Elizabeth's strong, quick hands as she pulled a gray-white dough ball toward her, kneading air into biscuits for the master's breakfast table. When her mother finished the cooking, it was Suzette's job to run the food to the big house while it was still hot and to serve the table. D'Urban. Frais Dieu. She silently practiced her speaking voice in time to the paddle, hoping her mother would make conversation. Elizabeth hummed as she worked, her tune deep, slow, and plaintive. Suzette wasn't sure of her mood. Her mother had never taken to Creole French, even the rough version they spoke in the quarter. Elizabeth never achieved the same slurry rhythm that everyone else from the house used. "How was church?" Elizabeth finally asked.
"Saint Augustine was beautiful."
"Belle," Suzette pronounced carefully, wrapping her lips around the word, hoping her French sounded as refined as Orleans, imagining her words flowing as smoothly as those she had heard this morning at the church. "Old Bertram and I stood outside, but he found us a place where we could see into the sanctuary.
Sanctuaire. Monsieur, Madame, and Mademoiselle sat behind a row of gens de couleur libre."
Suzette could still feel the wonder of the morning, the long ride in the wagon pressed between Orléans and Narcisse Frédieu, seeing for the first time the broad bell of St. Augustine above the vestibule, the shimmery waves rising off the sun-baked tiles on the gabled roof, the brightly colored glass, but mostly the clusters of people. White, colored, Negro, free and slave, all dressed fine, all in one place. Elizabeth grunted. "The free people of color who built their church own more slaves than the Durbans. They go by their own rules," she said.
"I saw him, Mère. When he came outside, I saw Augustine Metoyer himself. I was as close to him as I stand to you now. You should hear him talk. More proper than Monsieur Louis, and his top hat was silk."
Suzette closed her eyes to bring back the images of the morning. Augustine Metoyer was the most famous of all the gens de couleur libre. The closest she had ever been to Cane River royalty before was her godmother, a free woman who had married into that famous family.
"I wanted to go inside. Old Bertram went in for a few minutes and took communion while I waited."
Suzette was sorry her mother had never seen St. Augustine, that she and old Bertram were the only slaves who had been allowed off the plantation.
"Just do your work, Suzette," Elizabeth said. "We have 10 to feed this morning, and I still have Mademoiselle Orleans' birthday supper to make."
"Mademoiselle promised to leave some of everything on her plate for me tonight, since it's almost my birthday, too."
Elizabeth said nothing, began to hum again. Suzette wished her mother would send her on an errand, away for a time from all of the eyes that sought her out night and day. She would slip off her shoes and walk, with the rich Louisiana soil under her feet and between her toes, and carry back a pail of fresh cow's milk without spilling any, or bring in more wood for the fire, or gather green beans from the big garden to string and snap later. She was 8 years old today, would be 9 tomorrow, and she was meant for the house, not the field. Everyone, white, colored, and Negro, told her how much pride there was in that. On good days, Elizabeth would tell Suzette interesting things, mostly about cooking or preserving or flavoring, and sometimes she would compare Rosedew with the plantation she had come from in Virginia.
"This big house is puny next to some," Elizabeth would declare. "In Virginia," her mother said, "the big house had an upstairs, a downstairs, and thick white columns in the front. There were separate servants for every task, and each one of them had assistants."
The big house on Rosedew was slung low, a one-story house of wood and brick frame, stuccoed in white and topped with a long, sloping roof. There were 6 rooms that Suzette helped clean, and a special bedroom for visitors, the stranger's room, with its own separate entrance from the outside for passers-by on the river who might need a place to stay overnight. More often, as when the entire Frédieu family stayed over, it was used for the Durbans' relatives who came calling by the day or week or month. Beneath her madras tignon, Elizabeth's broad, dark face was streaked with a mixture of sweat from the heat of the cookhouse fires and a film of fine white flour from her morning baking. The sleeves on her long calico summer dress were pushed up above her elbows, and Suzette could see the old leathery burn marks on the brown skin of her mother's arms, from her many years as a cook, from boiling kettles and the big smoky fireplace and sizzling skillets. Suzette looked down at her own skinny arms, wishing they were pale and white like Orleans, instead of the color of cocoa.
"Mamselle and I went down to the quarter yesterday."
For Suzette, there were real smells in the quarter no one tried to mask, loud sounds no one tried to quiet, and large motions no one tried to subdue. Weekdays, only the smallest children were there, along with those too old for the field, the sick, new mothers, and the old woman who took care of all the little ones. Everyone else was gone, working sun up to sun down. After dark, everyone was usually too tired from the day in the field to do much more than prepare their evening meal of ground cornmeal and their ration of bacon. A handful of meal, a little water, a pinch of lard, into the ashes to cook, and fall into bed exhausted after eating. But Saturday, after half-day labor, the quarter came alive with each household working their own patch garden, washing clothes, trading gossip, and bringing back fish or game along with stories of how they had caught it. Children mixed at will, white and black, broadcloth and homespun, nearly masters and nearly slaves, not yet fully grown into their roles. Suzette's family lived in the quarter, including two sisters and a younger brother. There were moments when she wondered what it would have been like to live there instead of the big house.
"Papa made up two songs, one for Mamselle's birthday and a different one for mine."
Her father, Gerasim, never gave Suzette hard looks when she used her house voice, unlike some others in the quarter. He was coppery brown, small-framed, and always glad to see her, no matter how tired he might be. With his booming laugh, he called her his big-eyed gal. Gerasim's wild mane of springy black hair couldn't decide whether to stay down or curl up, so it did both, and his face was so smooth that he didn't have to shave like the other men. When Suzette had asked him about it, he'd said it was because he was half-Indian. Her father was a favorite in both the quarter and the big house because he played the fiddle, and Louis Derban often got requests to rent him out for the frequent parties held up and down Cane River. Suzette grew quiet when Madame Françoise Derban swept into the cookhouse, the silk of her pale green visiting dress rustling. Françoise's heavily corseted build was typical of well-fed Creole ladies, and her fading brown hair had been darkened with coffee grounds water and upswept into calculated curls. Both her pointed nose and chin were inclined slightly, and her feet were nestled in black high-top shoes with leather-covered buttons. Usually she had Elizabeth come to her in the dark back room of the big house to decide on the menus for the week. But from time to time she appeared in the cookhouse unannounced, being careful not to let anything touch her or her fine clothes. It was an old ceremony between the mistress and her cook, and they'd been acting it out since Elizabeth had come to the plantation 15 years before.
"Elizabeth?"
Madame said, crinkling her nose as if she had caught wind of something slightly foul.
"I've just talked to Aureline, and I want today's supper to be special. I have promised her a birthday treat of her favorites.
There will be 10 of us in all."
"Yes'm, Madame Françoise," said Elizabeth, eyes still on her work table, hands never stopping their rhythm. Suzette tried not to smile as she watched the two women, one tall with skin the color of day-old grits, the other short and dark. She had already told her mother each of the choices she and Orlean had decided upon.
"We will have chicken and tasso jambalaya, sweet potato pone, green beans, kala with the gooseberry preserves we put up last year, and peach cobbler,"
Françoise instructed.
"Yes'm."
Suzette was surprised Madame could not smell the peaches hidden in the pantry. Their aroma still lingered in the air of the cookhouse, competing with the sharp yeast smell of the starter sponge for kala that they had concocted the night before, holding the promise of the rice fritters to come. She had peeled the potatoes for her mother and had been careful to watch how Elizabeth combined the boiled potatoes, cornmeal, flour, and cooking soda, and left it in the night air to ferment before mixing in the boiled rice to make the sponge. Just before mealtime would come the flour, eggs, butter, and milk, the stiff batter to beat, the dropping of the kalas by the spoonful onto the blistering skillet. "I give you my permission to go to the smokehouse after breakfast and get the ham and one jar of preserves," Madame said with a slight nod of her head. "Yes'm." Madame Francoise walked a few steps toward the doorway and then turned back. Her tone had a scolding edge. "You use far too much sugar in your last peach cobbler, Elizabeth, and Monsieur Durban got an upset stomach. Use less sugar this time."
"Yes'm."
The last time Suzette had served her mother's peach cobbler, she had spent half of that night cleaning up after Louis Durban. Elizabeth herself had told Suzette that Monsieur was ill because he had drunk too much bourbon. Her mother had done nothing wrong. Suzette stood to her full height, the butter paddle still in her hands. "Madame," she said eagerly to Françoise Durban, "it was the bourbon that made him sick, not the sugar." Suzette's words fell into the damp, dead air and hung there. Each of the three stood rooted in the cookhouse, the white woman's lips reducing to an astonished slim line, the black woman's face turning in on itself, her eyes closing briefly, and the suddenly uncertain little cocoa-colored girl letting her arms fall limply to her side. A fly buzzed sluggishly toward the open doorway. Françoise Durban's eyes flickered hot. She turned, took three quick steps toward Suzette, and slapped her hard with the green-gloved hand across the right side of her face, fingers spread wide. She squinted at Elizabeth.
"I won't be contradicted," she said, her voice wavering slightly. "You need to teach the girl her place."
She wheeled around and walked deliberately out of the cookhouse. Françoise Durban had never slapped Suzette in the face before, and it took a moment for her to start to cry. After the first startled tears, she looked toward her mother, who continued working the ball of dough.
"I didn't mean to be bad, Mère."
Elizabeth sprinkled more flour on the work table and roughly pulled down the rolling pin.
"Your little girl days are done."
At first, her tone provided no opening, but then it softened.
"Come over here, Suzette."
Suzette obeyed slowly, sniffling. A single plump tear stood perched on the high ridge of Suzette's cheek, refusing to drop to the red outline below where Madame had slapped her. Elizabeth reached over and, with her broad thumb, pushed the wetness away, leaving a thin trace of white flour in its place.
"Mère?"
Elizabeth had returned to her dough, humming. Suzette felt the stinging on her face, the heat of the fires, the stickiness of her shift against her skin. She stared at the old burn spot shaped like a quarter moon on the inside of her mother's exposed arm, fascinated by how perfectly the tips curved in toward each other. She was tempted to reach out and touch it.
"How many times have I told you to keep that mouth from running?" Elizabeth said. "There's lots worse than slapping."
She didn't often look angry, but now she pounded at the dough as if she were scrubbing clothes on the washboard.
"It wasn't fair," Suzette said stubbornly. "There is no fair. Just do your work, Suzette."
Suzette went back to the churn.
Durban, Durban.
The paddle resisted more with each movement until she had butter. She spooned it out, rocking herself in place where she stood, her face settling into a dull ache, while Elizabeth's big wooden rolling pin gave out stubborn squeaks with each pass over the dough.
"Mère, I finished the butter."
"Is the table set?"
"Oui."
"Then come watch," Elizabeth said. "Your time's coming soon enough to make the biscuits."
This seemed like safer ground to Suzette, and she held on to it. "Can I help you today if Mademoiselle Arline doesn't need me?" Elizabeth showed the beginnings of a rare smile, partially exposing the gap between her two front teeth, a gap that matched Suzette's own. "I'm gonna make you a little secret peach cobbler for your birthday tomorrow. No telling anybody else, even Mademoiselle." Elizabeth reached out and touched Suzette's arm, insistent, the almost smile fading. "Understand?" she said. "Not even Mademoiselle." Suzette nodded. "Should I run and get more peaches?" she asked. "First use those young legs to go get me some more sugar. One extra cup and we'll make sure this peach cobbler bubbles up nice and sweet for Mademoiselle Arline." The ache had faded from her cheek by the time Suzette served the breakfast of tamales, tortillas, sausages, blood pudding, and biscuits to the Derbans and their visiting house guests. They were 10 around the long dining room table, and the adults seemed in high spirits. She dished the sausages out of the platter for everyone around the table, coming last to Orlean's cousin Narcisse Fredieu, a pudgy boy with light brown thick hair clumped in waves hugging his head. Suzette stayed close to the table, hoping to hear the Derbans and the Fredieus talk about St. Augustine. For a long while, the breakfast conversation meandered lazily from the price of cotton and old people's ailments, to the poison grass creeping up from the marsh, what the weather was likely to be, and the heavy responsibilities of the planter class. She'd heard all of that before.
"I tell you, brother, the seating arrangement is improper at St. Augustine. White sitting behind colored,"
Narcisse's mother complained.
"We were meant for better."
Suzette waited to see what would happen next. Orlean had told her that the Fredieus were not exactly de la fine fleur des pois, not the most select blooms of the sweet pea blossom, and the marriage of Narcisse's mother to a Fredieu had been below her place. On many of their visits, Suzette had overheard Narcisse's mother, a Derban, talk about her family's quality, with history and distinction in the bloodline. She passed on her family stories, bold and proud tales of the original French settlers in Louisiana. She was silent on the subject of the Fredieu's background.
"They reserved the 8 rows for their better sister," Louis responded. "Only Augustine's family is in front. He did pay for the church, after all."
Françoise cleared her throat to speak.
"We should go to the Nakitosh church," she said, and her voice rose slightly. "It dismays me to have to consort so closely with the gens de couleur libre."
Suzette knew she really meant her godmother Doralise. Even the mention of Doralise Derban could trigger an ugly mood in Françoise. Louis Derban had freed Doralise when she was still a nursing baby, acknowledging her so openly as his daughter that she had taken his last name as her own, even in public, making it impossible for Françoise Derban to deny the obvious, as she had done with the others. Suzette's godmother, her marraine, occupied a middle place, not as high as the white Derbans or the Fredieus, and not as low as any of those she sponsored as godmother from the house or the quarter. She was a woman of color and free. All eyes at the table shifted from Françoise to Louis Derban. He looked the part of the older generation Creole French planter, from his pomaded thinning gray hair to his black suit and riding boots. The role had been handed to him whole on the day he was born.
"We have had this conversation before," he said. "I will not drive all the way to Nakitosh, where there is a perfectly acceptable chapel on the river."
Françoise gave ground in the face of opposition from her husband.
"With the infidel Creoles around Cane River, we were lucky our 8 rows were half full." "I understand your discomfort, my dear, but the best church is a church nearby."
Louis waved Suzette over for more blood pudding, and she hurried to his place at the head of the table.
"At least Saint Augustine draws the best of the gens de couleur libre,"
François conceded.
They do have the proper respect for whites, so crucial for the smooth running of a community. Thank goodness they don't consider themselves white, but they certainly don't consider themselves Negro either.
The children at the table, including Orlean and Narcisse, sat quiet as demanded, listening to the adults talk, joining in only for the singing after the meal. Midday, the Fredieus left Rosedew to return to their own plantation. Later that evening, Suzette helped Orlean undress for bed.
Mademoiselle Orlean, would you teach me reading?
I cannot, Suzette. You must stop asking. You know as well as I do that you are not allowed. Besides, it is no good for you to try to learn something so hard. Your ideas are wicked.
Just a few words. My name?
I will not, Orlean insisted.
What if we don't tell?
No. Aunt Françoise would be very angry if she found out.
Why would you want to read anyway? Even Aunt Françoise doesn't know how.
Suzette stopped to consider. The Durbans had taken Orlean in when her parents died, and Orlean would never disobey either Françoise or Louis. Still, she persisted.
In church today, I could not follow what the priest said.
He talks most of the time in Latin, Orlean said. Nobody understands.
But I want to take communion. Old Bertram went inside the church today like everyone else.
You do not have to know how to read to take communion.
I can ask Aunt Françoise to give her permission for you to take classes when I do. Besides, I will always be around if there is something to be read.
Orlean gave Suzette a secret, reassuring side glance when Françoise came in to lead the two girls in bedtime prayers.
Aunt Françoise, can Suzette take communion with me?
Françoise looked from one girl to the other.
First communion is not until you are 12, and requires serious study to get ready.
I would help her, said Orlean.
Your behavior today did not show you as a very good follower of Christ, Suzette, Françoise said. You have failed to be properly obedient.
I can be good, Madame Françoise. I do want to take communion like Mademoiselle Orlean. Old Bertram told me he was confirmed when he was a boy.
We will see how you conduct yourself.
Françoise sat in the cane-bottomed chair beside the four-poster bed, perched tentatively, as if prepared for any turn of events.
Orlean, tonight you will start to learn the Lord's Prayer.
Orlean repeated each passage after her aunt, and then Françoise kissed her niece lightly on the forehead.
When you are ready to be confirmed, you will wear a beautiful white dress and a veil, and I will get you your own rosary beads.
Françoise looked to Suzette, standing near the foot of the bed.
And you, Suzette, if you apply yourself, you can rise above your mother and the others in the quarter.
She straightened her skirts and prepared to retire to her own room.
Time for bed. Good night.
Suzette made her rounds of the big house, pulling the drapes, emptying the spittoons, and gathering everyone's dirty laundry. She checked on each member of the household to see if they needed her for anything before she returned to Orlean's room, where she blew out the candles and pulled out her palette from under the bed. Early the next morning, on her 9th birthday, before the household stirred, she made her way to Françoise Durban's favorite rose bush. Chapter 2. Cane River, Louisiana, 1837. Suzette felt the weight of the rosary alongside her lucky strip of cowhide, safely sheltered in her apron pocket. If her hands hadn't been covered with butter, she would have taken a moment to finger the beads again, memorizing their shapes and sizes. She stood opposite her mother across the work table in the cookhouse, her hands almost as fast as Elizabeth's as she greased several baking pans.
That dress turned out fine, Elizabeth said and smiled. Change right after breakfast.
It was as if her mother were the one who had just had her first communion, not Suzette. As if it were Elizabeth who had studied the Lord's Prayer and the Catechism, side by side with Orlean and Narcisse and 21 other 12-year-olds from Cane River, at the hands of unforgiving nuns to prepare for this big day.
"I wish you could have seen me at St. Augustine, Mère," Suzette said.
Elizabeth sniffed. "Plenty to do here."
"All the girls had on long white dresses and veils, and all the boys had on black suits. My dress was just as good as the others. Outside in front of the church, Madame Françoise gave Mademoiselle Orlean and me our own rosaries with pretty white beads and a silver chain. I get to keep it always, she said so. And the bishop came all the way from New Orleans to give us our first communion, and he had a big ring on his finger, and we marched into the church in a line with our candles lit, and I got to go inside the church along with everyone else at the back, and the bishop came down to the altar rail and gave us the body and blood of Christ. And I took the wafer under my tongue just like we practiced, and didn't spill any of the wine, even though I shook a little. And I was so nervous, but I did it perfect, and..."
"Slow yourself down, girl," Elizabeth said. "You have the whole day for telling while we get the place ready for the food and dancing tonight."
"It's called a soirée dansante, Mère. Remember? I told you before."
Even her mother's deliberate refusal to call things by their proper names could not interfere with Suzette's outlook on the world today. "Separate whites and yolks of about 6 of those eggs," Elizabeth said, using her apron to wipe the beads of perspiration from her forehead. "Who was there?"
"Monsieur and Madame. Monsieur held Madame's arm and they went into the church, but it was more like she was holding him up. They told me that I had grown into a respectful young woman."
Suzette was so preoccupied with her cooking and the telling that she didn't see her mother push her lips together tight. And the Frédiers were there for Narcisse, and the Moulins came for Nicolas. "I see how you look at the Moulin boy. Don't get to thinking they are mixed with us." Suzette felt her cheeks go warm, thinking of the scrap of cowhide pushed deep into her apron pocket.
"Nicolas has always been nice to me," she said primly.
"There's nice that's how neighbors do, and nice that you can hang some part of a life on. Even if Nicolas had a pull in your direction, his family wouldn't stand for it."
Suzette could not pinpoint exactly when it was that her mother had turned so full of doom, but some days it was almost impossible to listen to her and not talk back. As if Suzette didn't know the Jean de Couleur Libre chose free women to marry so that the children would be born free. Nicolas was different, more like her godmother, Doralise. They were both free people of color, but they never looked past her as if she were not really there. Whenever she saw Nicolas, it was as if everything around her drifted out of focus except for him, and she had a difficult time doing the simplest things. Nicolas was following in his father's trade of a shoemaker, and she saw him when he had made the deliveries to Rosedew, and when they met at St. Augustine to study for First Communion. She had known Nicolas since they were both children, but in the last few months something had changed. When she asked him how he made shoes, he had brought her a small scrap of cowhide to show the untanned leather he and his father worked from. Since it was a discard, he'd let her keep it. Now she found herself at odd moments wondering what it would be like to run her fingers over the freckles that crisscrossed his cheeks, or to dance the waltz with him, which would mean she would be so close that she would have to tilt her head just so and look up at him. Nicolas always spoke kindly to her at St. Augustine, or when she saw him on his horse on the road. She had to put forth a great deal of effort to speak to him, and afterwards she always felt as if she had embarrassed herself somehow, or at least had not shown herself off very well. Nicolas' very presence made her voice small and her knees unpredictable. Suzette knew her mother couldn't possibly understand. She didn't understand it herself.
"Marraine Doralise wasn't born free," Suzette said, "but she's free now and was married in a church."
"Monsieur had his own reasons to make her free and set her up to marry."
You asked her to stand up and be my godmother when I was born, and she did, Suzette persisted. The gens de couleur libre are not all the same.
Pay attention to your work. We don't have time to let those roles rise again if you mess them up now.
Elizabeth pursed her lips and shook her head.
Who else was there this morning?
Marraine Doralise and Monsieur Philippe were there for Elisada, and Marraine came over to congratulate me when Madame stepped away. I told you she's not like the rest.
Elizabeth let it pass.
How did Philippe look?
He did all right in the chapel, but after the ceremony he followed Doralise out to the road and screamed in her face in front of everyone. His brother had to pull him away. Nicolas says Monsieur Philippe acts the fool even in front of white folks now. Elisada looked like she was gonna cry. I felt sorry for her, even if she does think she's better than everybody else.
Don't be so eager to judge, Suzette. You can't tell how heavy somebody else's load is just from looking. The Lord doesn't give us more than we can carry, but he's putting it to the test with Madame de Relise. A shame, with Monsieur Philippe coming from such a good family.
Even Narcisse was nice to Elisida after that, Suzette said.
That boy always has been a puzzle, Elizabeth said. Both sides of a coin at the same time. Sweet and helpful, or spoiled and full of himself. No telling which way he'll turn out.
Mademoiselle Orleans said in the wagon on the way back that we should think about becoming nuns, Suzette said.
Elizabeth cocked her head to one side.
Mademoiselle doesn't know what she wants.
I know what I want.
Suzette thought of Nicolas.
I want to stand up in St. Augustine in a white dress and get married the way Marraine de Relise did.
Daydreaming about the white dress always brought Nicolas to mind, standing next to her.
But it doesn't matter, Suzette said petulantly. What could I do anyway if Mademoiselle wanted something else?
Elizabeth wiped her hands on her apron and looked hard into Suzette's eyes.
You do whatever you can think of to protect you and yours. You're better than most at getting along with the folks up to the house. Too good, maybe.
The two worked in silence for a while.
Those dresses came out fine, Elizabeth began again in a conciliatory tone. You should let Gerasim see how you look.
You just want me to go down to the quarter.
The big house isn't all there is. Your people are in the quarter.
It's too dirty down there. Papa can see the dress tonight at the party. Mademoiselle's gonna wear hers, too.
Suzette, you'll be serving, not dancing. Your gingham will do.
Madame Francoise already said I could wear it.
Elizabeth stopped whipping the eggs in the bowl and leaned across to Suzette, speaking slowly and deliberately, each word snapping like bed sheets drying on the line in a biting wind.
I'm glad you're getting on so well with the Durbans, but you have a mother and a father both, and they don't live up to the house. You come on out of your head and see how things really are. Any of us could be sold tomorrow. Praise the Lord it hasn't happened yet to our family here on Rosedew, but that doesn't mean it can't.
Suzette kept her head down and her tongue quiet. But she seethed inside at how her mother was purposely trying to ruin her big day. She didn't understand why her mother couldn't see that she wanted something better, that she had the chance to be more than her father's sister and brother, who were already getting ground down going into the field every day. More than her mother, who didn't practice the way that Suzette did to sound like the ones with last names, who still clung to her old-timey religion when no one was around. Just today, Suzette was the only slave from Rosedew to take First Communion in a real church, one of only a handful from Cane River who wasn't either white or free, and she had marched into St. Augustine with the rest. Couldn't her mother see she had a bigger future in store? Elizabeth had not finished.
You have only one family, and not everybody gets that.
Think about where you want to put trust. Reaching too deep into something not meant for you is full of pain. Figure out what you can have and work on that. You only get one family. Her mother looked fierce. Now do your work, Suzette. Sunday night was perfect for the Durban party. It was dry and crisp, lit up bright by a full moon, lanterns, and high spirits. The first flurry of guests arrived, their cheeks flushed from the cold in anticipation, shedding their overcoats and wraps, eager to show off their party finery. Elizabeth and Suzette had fixed a double pot of steaming gumbo, and a whole pig in a pit had been slow-roasting since the night before. The dancing began in earnest soon after the food was served. Wide cypress planks had been laid down in the barn as a dance floor, and the boards strained under the weight of Creoles, young and old, dancing to Gerasim's tunes. Suzette watched from the sidelines as the carefree couples spun, her feet aching to join them as she circled the room to serve food or drink or clean up spills. It was too cold to stay outdoors, and the house was not large enough for all of the friends the Durbans had invited, so the party was held in stages, from the big house to the barn and several points in between. The guests danced set after set of the quadrille waltz, until only the most hardy were able to negotiate the dance floor. The week had been filled with hundreds of big and small orders coming Suzette's way, from Françoise, Elizabeth, and Orlean, as well as the priest. It had been exhausting and thrilling, practicing for First Communion, the ceremony in the church, all of the planning for the big party tonight, the cooking, scrubbing, helping Orlean practice the steps to the quadrille waltz, getting her confident enough to make a public dancing appearance. Orlean had kissed Suzette on the cheek earlier that afternoon and declared herself ready. Just a few feet away, Suzette watched Narcisse and Orlean taking their place among the young adults of French Cane River Society. Narcisse was on his most exemplary behavior tonight, pulled between two of the things he loved best, food and dance. He had grown taller and thinner in the last few months, and was playing the perfect gentleman with his cousin Orlean, initiating small talk, making sure she danced, bringing her food and punch. As the party wore on and the night turned cooler, Narcisse gestured Suzette over to where he stood surrounded by his cousins in the barn. Her heart skipped, and she rushed over to them.
"Girl, go get cousin Azélie her wrap. Don't dawdle."
Suzette stood a moment too long, unmoving.
"Go on,"
Narcisse said, his voice impatient. Girl, as if they'd never played together and shared secrets, as if they had not all taken their first communion together that morning. Suzette glanced over to where Orlean sat, but Orlean had fixed her gaze to a spot on the opposite wall as if she couldn't hear. Gerasim played another quadrille, sounds of excited talk and laughter mixed with the steady patter of metered feet on the cypress planks. Suzette turned toward the house. There was nothing to do but fetch the wrap. They had cleared out the minor furniture and pulled up the rugs to make room for dancing inside, pushing small tables toward the wall for checkers, backgammon, dominoes, ramps, and mahjong, especially for the older men whose dancing days had wound down. The guests were mostly the usual from Cane River, extended family and neighbors, but there were a few fresh faces. The star of the evening was Eugène Dorat, newly arrived from France. He was short and neatly dressed, had startling black eyes, and the smallest feet Suzette had ever seen on a man. His dark brown hair was slicked down to one side and tucked behind his tiny ears, and he smiled at everyone he was introduced to, as if it gave him the greatest pleasure to be alive in a world that had dancing in it. He was a curious fellow, his pale skin the dull white of goat's milk. He seemed to Suzette to be a little doll man. He was some sort of relation to Françoise from the Rachal side. To Suzette, Eugène was brand new. She found herself pulled to wherever he was,
to try to get another look at those eyes without seeming to look at him directly. Louis was an impressive host, welcoming everyone full of good cheer. Suzette circled around one more time in the front room with her tray of special hors d'oeuvres, and Louis called her over.
"You better try one of these crab cakes," he announced to the collection of men gathered around him. "Our girl Suzette makes the finest dipping sauce this side of the Mississippi River."
He turned and spoke another language to a tall, thin man with light hair and a wispy beard, a distant cousin of the Durbans from Virginia, and the two men had a private laugh. The bearded man could only smile and gesture to the others, and he stayed close to Louis, the only one among them who could talk with him in English. The cousin reminded Suzette of her older sister Palmillo, deaf and dumb since birth, neither of them able to make themselves understood in a group, except through signals or translators. Still, the man seemed to be enjoying himself, drinking and dancing with the rest.
"What other delights have you and Elizabeth cooked up?" Louis asked Suzette.
Suzette could tell by his tone, but even more by the flush in his cheeks and the color of his nose, that Louis was in the mischievous stage of his evening drinking. The doll man looked directly at her and grinned, a white, dazzling smile that showed his square, even teeth, and he held her gaze. Suzette took her tray of crab cakes and backed out of the room to cover her confusion. When some of the older men retired to their brandy and cigars around the back room fireplace, Suzette followed to serve. It was less painful than going back outside where Orlean and Narcisse were. These men had done their obligatory turn on the dance floor, and now were settled in for camaraderie and companionship with other French Creole planters, leaving the more active entertainment to their children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. Both the doll man and the English-speaking cousin had been invited to sit with them. Louis Durban settled into his leather chair and called for cigars, which Suzette retrieved. Suzette lit Louis' cigar first, watching his spotted hands, always in slight motion, the way the highest branches looked in the pecan tree when the trunk was being shaken to get the nuts to fall.
"You see the sense of our ways, the advantages of how we do things, after you've been here a while, Eugène," Louis said, continuing some earlier conversation. "The plantation is the fulfillment of God's design."
Suzette knew what came next, having heard so many of Louise Durban's monologues that her mind could fly ahead to the pauses. By the tone, she knew this was his "our burden is heavy" speech, but she listened carefully anyway in case there were clues about the doll man.
"You're a merchant at heart, Eugène. Too new to this country to understand our way of life yet. We have a responsibility here that we take seriously. The Lord Almighty blesses our system, and we do what is best for everyone. Our black family could not survive on their own. We have to protect them, as much from themselves as from others. We feed and clothe them, and take care of all their needs when they are too young, too old, or too sick to work. Slavery is the only workable system for cotton production, as good for our Negroes as it is for the whites. We took them out of Africa and lifted them up. The planters set the tone for the rest. Our burden is heavy."
Louis shook his head sadly.
"There are some who do not exercise good sense, treating their Negroes worse than their oxen. But that's just a handful, ignorant enough to damage their own property. Not one of mine ever gets more than 20 lashes without my permission. Not like on McAlpin's place, where one of his boys almost bled out from the beating he gave him last month. The church teaches us they have souls, and they have to be faithfully led."
They talked as if Suzette were not in the room, refilling glasses, stoking the fire, emptying spittoons. She felt Eugène Dorat's bold eyes on her, so she made herself small, careful not to make any response or acknowledgement of his stare. A little before midnight, Eugène called for the wine he had brought for his host. Suzette carried the gift bottle and 8 fresh glasses on a silver tray to the circle of planters, placing them in front of the doll man. Earlier in the evening, he had uncorked the bottle with great fanfare, and now he waved her away, choosing to do the pouring himself. It was an 1825 Bordeaux, Chateau Lafitte Rothschild, a vintage wine of early harvest that he had brought from France. Eugène poured, and Suzette took the silver tray around to the men in the room until each held a wine glass.
"To new beginnings in a land of opportunity," Eugène toasted, and they all raised the wine to their lips.
Suzette turned to tend the fire as they once again fell to casual conversation.
"So, Eugène, as a well-traveled man, what do you think of this wine?"
Louis d'Urban asked contentedly, balancing the half-empty wine glass in one hand.
"I confess to being more of a bourbon man myself."
Eugène directed his attention to his host, raising his eyes from 12-year-old Suzette's back as she poked at the red embers of the fire and added another log to the failing flames.
"This Bordeaux caused a great deal of excitement in France," the doll man said. "Look at the lovely color."
He held the wine glass closer to the lamp, allowing the flame to bring out the intensity of the crimson liquid.
"It has a ravishing bouquet and a flavor to match. I confess, an 1825 Lafitte may still be a bit young, but sometimes it can be difficult to wait," he said.
Chapter 3. Christmas Day was dry and chilly. The crop had been a good one this year, in a succession of very good years, and the talk of the quarter for the prior 2 weeks had turned to what the gifts would likely be. It was certain that there would be the big contest for the best cuts of beef, and 1 bottle of liquor for each man, and new blankets, but they couldn't guess the surprise. They speculated that whatever it was would be store-bought, since no one from the house or the field had had a hand in its preparation. Maybe broadcloth for new trousers or seed for their gardens. The week before Christmas and New Year's would pass without any heavy field work, only music and food, singing, dancing, and drinking. Visiting, fishing, courting, and sleeping in until after the sun was already up. Friends and family gathering in the light of daytime, mothers nursing their babies according to the baby's need instead of the plantation bell. Traveling to other plantations to see family. The luxury of planning. Planning the flow of each day for 1 full week. No cotton would be planted, hoed, or picked. When the plantation bell sounded, it would mark the passage of time, but it would not begin the march to the north field before sunrise. No backs stooped over this week except to work a personal patch or bend over a checkerboard. No long sack hung around the neck to drag between endless rows of cotton plants. No weighing of each basket at twilight to measure performance against quota. No bold script recording 175 pounds next to the name Palmier in the big plantation book. 203 for Gerasim, 46 for Solitaire, just starting out at the age of 11 as a 1/4 hand. Suzette wiped her forehead with the back of her sleeve while she threw pine chips into the cookhouse fireplace. The flames spat and burned hotter.
"Christmas morning, and we're the only ones working," she grumbled under her breath. "Don't try to match up one misery against another," Elizabeth said. "Field or house, we're all in the same web, waiting for the spider to get home."
Elizabeth never broke her rhythm as she stirred the batter for griddle cakes. She had spent the night down in the quarter with Gerasim and was in a very good mood.
"Besides, there's no talk for Christmas," she went on. "This is the Lord's Day."
If Suzette was cheerful, her mother's response was likely to be full of gloom. If Suzette was sulky, it would be something full of false hope and cheer. But even as she was complaining, Suzette's heart wasn't really in it. Tonight was the big quarter Christmas party at Rosedew. Some of the slaves owned by their smaller neighbors would be coming, including the three from François Moulin's farm. Suzette wished that Nicolas would come, but the gens de couleur libre kept to their own for social occasions. It seemed to Suzette that Nicolas saved his smiles for her since their communion classes, and she certainly saved her thoughts for him. She still kept the scrap of cowhide he had given her close at hand, most times in her apron pocket or hidden beneath her palette. Nicolas had dreams, planning to have his own place along Cane River by hiring himself out. But Nicolas or no, Suzette intended to have fun tonight. Only 13, Suzette had already sold some of her baking along Cane River. She had even been rented out once to the Rachal place for one of their big parties. She sometimes sneaked her cooking to her family, but tonight they could enjoy their treats out in the open without the risk of being caught. Determined to make this Christmas feast the best yet on Rosedew, she and Elizabeth had been cooking for days. They would serve up portions for the Durbans separately, but the rest was for the tables that had been set up in the barn, where the entire quarter would gather. On Christmas Day, everyone could have as much to eat as they wanted. Suzette did a few sample steps of the waltz with an elaborate dip at the end in her mother's direction. Elizabeth laughed, and peace was restored. "Can I wear my first communion dress for the party?" Suzette asked.
"I hope it still fits," Elizabeth said. "You're growing more curves every day."
"I heard Monsieur Louis talking to Monsieur Eugène Dorat," Suzette said. "He said the week off between Christmas and New Year's is just a way to make the hands more manageable the rest of the year, to let them blow off steam so they don't get ideas about running."
"Let us blow off steam," Elizabeth corrected. "We're all in the same web."
"Anyway, he invited Monsieur Eugène to come to the big contest."
"Suzette, I want you to stay away from that little man as much as you can. Try not to be alone with him."
"He means no harm, Mère."
"The man already struts around this place like he owns it, like everything here is his for the taking. Tell me you'll take care."
Eugène had been nice to Suzette, always had an easy smile for her.
"Yes, Mère."
"We're ready,"
Elizabeth said, making one last inspection of the griddle.
"Let's go on up to the house."
There was a small crowd from the quarter outside of the big house. Gerasim, hair wild and eyes alert, drew his jacket tighter around his body against the chill. He had chosen a place nearest the front door to stand, and his children, Palmyre, Afia, and Solitaire, flanked him. Suzette and Elizabeth headed toward them.
"First light come and gone," Gerasim said when he saw Elizabeth. "They're starting late."
As if on cue, Louis, Françoise, and Orléans came out onto the front gallery still in their nightclothes. Louis rubbed his eyes and yawned.
"What are you all doing here?" he asked gruffly. "Christmas gifts," they shouted back in one voice. "Surely it isn't Christmas already."
Gerasim spoke up.
"Monsieur, it surely is."
Louis looked doubtful and slowly drew his fingers around his hair.
"I may have something I could find to give," he said at last, and with a great flourish he drew the cover off the makeshift table set up against the front of the house.
Underneath were 48 Christmas stockings, each filled with nuts, oranges, apples, pecan candy, and a 10-hole harmonica for each hand over the age of 5. As they came forward to receive their stocking, Louis greeted each by name. All men got a jug of whiskey, each woman a length of muslin and gabardine, and everyone received their new blanket for the year. Suzette and Elizabeth slipped away while Louis was still handing out gifts and began to serve up the breakfast of scrambled eggs, smoked ham, flapjacks with cane syrup, and café noir. There was to be an uninterrupted flow of food of every description all day long, and it would be considered a sad failure if anyone left the tables hungry. By the time Louis, Françoise, Orline, and Eugène Dorat made their appearance at the annual celebration in the quarter, dressed in their finery, the party had been going for some time. By custom, they knew not to stay too long. Heaping platters of meat, vegetables, breads, and sweets were arranged on makeshift tables. Gumbo waited in the heavy black kettle steaming over an open fire. Old Bertram carved pieces from the crackling porker barbecuing in a deep pit.
"Time for the big contest," Louis announced, leading the way to one side of the barn. "Who's first?"
"Old Bertram's the oldest," came the shout back.
They cleared a path, and old Bertram came forward. Louis handed him a bow and arrow. Outlined on the side of the barn in charcoal was the crudely drawn picture of a cow, and old Bertram drew back the arrow and let it fly. The point made a soft thunk, landing near the top of the cow image's tail.
"Looks like old Bertram gets tail stew," Gerasim said, laughing. "I call that close enough for rump roast," Louis said.
Old Bertram looked very pleased with himself. He would get to keep a piece of the meat from that section of the cow to be slaughtered the next day.
"See if you can do better,"
old Bertram sniffed, giving up the bow and arrow to Gerasim. Gerasim took aim, and his arrow tip landed squarely in the center.
"Short line!"
Louis called out, and the crowd whistled and cheered. Some of the men had gotten such a head start on the whiskey, they had trouble hitting the target at all on the first try. After the big contest, Gerasim picked up his fiddle and the dancing began. Suzette watched her mother with delight. Elizabeth danced in the clearing with the others, her good lace scarf pulled across her shoulders and tied neatly in front of her ample chest, first flying up and then falling down with each movement. Eyes wide and full of spirit, she picked up her long skirt to give her feet more maneuvering room, looking at her partners, but more often over at Gerasim, playing his fiddle under the oak tree. Elizabeth smiled and winked at Gerasim, broadly, in front of the entire quarter, in front of the Durbans and their guests, and Gerasim winked back. Suzette found herself responding to the gaiety of the music, finally getting her chance to dance. She pulled first one and then another into the center of the dance floor, teaching anyone who didn't know the steps and wanted to learn. She danced the quadrille waltz and the fait dodo while her father played the fiddle. The fait dodo was her favorite, with six couples taking the lead from Gerasim as he called the figures in French faster and faster in a contest between dancer and musician. The dancers leaned on one another in exhaustion when the number was over, laughing and panting, hearts racing, adrenaline left over. Suzette closed her eyes, and she could see herself in her white dress in the chapel at St. Augustine, with Nicolas beside her. When she opened her eyes, Eugène Dorat was staring at her fixedly, familiarity in his gaze, as if there was some secret between them. Suzette pulled her eyes away from his, her confusion laced with a trace of shame, although she knew she had done nothing wrong. The music started up again, and her little brother Solataire tugged at her hand to dance. After the set finished, she decided to take herself away from the noise and closeness for a moment. The party would go on until almost dawn.
"You are a wonderful partner, brother," she said to Solataire with a fond smile. "I am counting on another dance as soon as I return."
She had not felt so free since she was a child. It was a crisp December evening, cold enough for Suzette to see traces of her own breath on the frosty air, but she had worked up a sweat. She headed off dreamily through the woods to cool off and to think in peace about the things tugging at her mind. Her family. Nicolas. It was a relief not to be under the watchful eye of so many masters in the big house, and for once Suzette felt grateful to be surrounded by people who looked like her. Living in the big house had made her forget this other self. She had been ashamed by the way her mother talked, the coarse clothes her sisters wore. All the distance and embarrassment had been forgotten tonight, until she'd looked over Solitaire's shoulder and caught herself in the mirror of Eugène Dorat's eyes. She walked sure-footed through the thick mass of pine trees, all the way down to her thinking rock on the bank of Cane River, a place she had found a few years past, after Orlean grew into more confidence and stopped pulling at her every minute. As Suzette looked off across the river, standing by her rock, she heard the soft squish of boots against mud, signaling a man's approach. Someone had followed her to her secret place.
"Ah, ma chère, I thought you would never stop walking," Eugène Dorat said as he emerged from the woods, slightly out of breath.
"I'm going right back." Suzette glanced nervously in the direction of the party, as if she could wish herself back to the center of the dance floor, surrounded by other people.
"I just came away from the party to cool off." "And are you so cool already?"
"It felt good to walk, Monsieur Eugène."
"Better for the young than for those of us who are older, I'm afraid," he said. "That's a pretty dress. A little thin for this time of year, but you make it look just right. If you are cold, I could lend you my coat."
"I think I should get back now, monsieur." Her voice sounded thin and tinny to her own ears.
"Just stay here with me for a little bit until I catch my breath. I might not be able to find my way back without you."
The frightful pounding behind Suzette's small breasts would not slow its pace. She wanted to run, but was afraid of insulting such a close friend of the master and mistress's. And he had said her dress was pretty.
"The music will guide you back." "Just give me a minute, Suzette."
He sat on the rock in no particular hurry.
"You seem different tonight than you do in the house," Eugène said. "Why is that?"
"Mademoiselle Orlean and I practiced the steps of the quadrille for the soiree last summer. I hadn't had a chance to dance them so much before."
"I see. You dance them as well as any I've seen. Even in France."
"Really?"
"Oui. When I saw you dance, you reminded me of my home in France. A town called Bordeaux. I miss it."
Suzette was curious.
"Why would I remind you of France, Monsieur Eugène?" "In France, they are full of life. You are full of life."
Eugène patted a spot next to him on the rock.
"Come, sit next to me for a moment."
What was she supposed to say? What was she supposed to do? Was he making fun of her? Did the Durbans know he was here with her, talking like this? Suzette edged closer toward the rock.
"It isn't right, Monsieur Eugène. I can just stand." "Nonsense," Eugène said. "You're cold. No more discussion. Come here."
Suzette cautiously balanced herself on the far flat edge of the rock, sitting but leaning away from the doll man. Eugène moved closer to Suzette and put his coat around her.
"I think you are so vibrant, Suzette, so full of joie de vivre. You make me forget myself."
She was trembling and could think of nothing to say.
"The Durbans say you are a good Catholic girl. Maybe you weren't thinking so much of the church when you were dancing tonight, eh? You have babies yet, little Suzette?"
"No, monsieur." Babies. Babies were for after she and Nicolas Moulin made plans. The moon's rays shimmering on the water's surface broke in odd places, confusing her. She felt rooted to the spot, Eugène now sitting by her side on her special rock, his arm around her shoulder. It wasn't real, being talked to in such soft tones by a white man with a last name. He shifted his position and rested his hand on her knee, as if it were his right.
Would it show poor upbringing to protest?
To run? Suzette stared at Eugène Dorat's little feet, unwilling to bring her eyes up any farther than that. Casually, he reached under her dress, under her bloomers, his hand cold and deliberate against her bare skin. She heard the sound of his jagged breathing and smelled the sharpness of liquor as it oozed from his pores.
Lay back, Suzette.
I'm a good girl, monsieur.
Yes, I'm sure you are.
His voice didn't sound the same, as if it were coming from somewhere lower and deeper as he pressed her back onto the unforgiving rock. He moved above her, making strange noises in his throat while he undid the buttons of his breeches with his free hand. He was heavy for a man so small. Everything was moving slowly, as if it had nothing at all to do with her. Like during a bad storm, when the water rose on the river so fast that you could only watch it spill the banks, and nothing any man did could stop it. He moved back and forth, pinning her, and she froze in the inescapable certainty of the moment. Nicolas, she thought unexpectedly. Nicolas should come and pull the doll man away, take her back to the party, ask her to dance. But try as she might, she could conjure up only his name, and not the kindness of Nicolas' face. Eugène's knee pried her open, and he pushed into her, delivering pain to a central place. He stayed on top of her, dead weight grinding her hip and shoulder into the rock, catching his breath